Are we live now?
I'm recording.
You're listening to Mumbrella Cast.
Mumbrella Cast.
Welcome to the Mumbrella Cast. I'm Deputy Editor Josie Tutty, and joining me to break down the week in media and marketing is News Editor Paul Woolbank.
Hi there.
And Senior Agencies Reporter Abigail Dawson.
Hello.
And later on, we'll be talking to Nick Jones, the CEO of Pure Profile, about the importance of simplicity.
And if you're going to sell something to somebody, if you can't explain it easily and help them understand what the benefit of buying whatever it is you're selling to them, you ain't going to be a successful salesperson.
Australia's place on the map.
In a properly global company, Australia is usually between 1% and 2% of your revenue.
And the recent executive team changes.
When we start somewhere, we all go, okay, is this, you know, what I expected it to be? Is this what I wanted it to be?
But first, the week's topics.
The government announces Ida Buttrose as ABC chair.
10 pools changing rooms.
And what happened when we crunched 5 years' worth of radio data?
So first up, the government has just announced Ida Buttrose as chair of the ABC. Paul, some are saying this wasn't the most obvious choice. What do you think now it's been announced?
Well, now it's been announced, it's starting to make a little bit more sense in that it could have been much, much worse. The coalition in particular, but governments of both shades, do have a really bad record of choices in chairs of the boards, and not just the ABC board, but other boards as well. However, if we'd been having this conversation last week and someone had said Ida Buttrose for this role, we would have all gone, no, you're smoking something. So this is really out of left field. I've got to say, though, watching her media conference with the Prime Minister at the time it was announced, she actually performed really well, and it looked like she'll have the spine to stand up to ministers and prime ministers that a lot of the more recent appointees haven't had, and certainly her predecessor certainly didn't have. One of the things that surprises me, though, is that anybody would take this role before the federal election, because after the federal election, all bets are off. It could be somebody completely different as minister or prime minister, or even if the coalition win, which a lot of people are pretty well writing them off. But if they do pull it off and get back into government, we may have a completely different prime minister, a completely different communications minister, and for whoever is the chairman of the ABC, they could be in a very, very difficult place. So she's got the experience as an executive editor at News Corp and a senior editor at Australian Consolidated Press under Kerry Packer. So she really has had she's dealt with the tough people at the big end of town before. So I think dealing with prime ministers and angry communications ministers, she'll probably do quite all right with that.
Now, she does have lots of experience in the media, but it was all relatively a long time ago now, several decades ago, that she was in those editorial positions. Do you think that's going to be a problem for her in the current digital landscape? You know, there's lots of talk about the issues around Facebook and Google, and it was actually something that was put to her in the conference this week. But do you think she has it in her to fully understand the landscape as it is now?
It is going to be a weakness, I think, because she has been out of the day-to-day media roles for 30 years. And of course, it may as well be a different century in that respect. Well, it is a different century. but the thing with it is that when you look at some of the stale, male, pale people that were being kicked around for it, a lot of them didn't really seem to have a lot of digital smarts either. And a lot of these long-established people that have been in the media space haven't performed that well with the digital change either. So maybe it's not going to be so bad. And again, when she was asked that at the press conference, her response was pretty impressive. And also Justin Milne, who was supposedly this digital wunderkind, the whole Project Jetstream, this was just fantasy stuff. Whereas I think Ida, the strength she's going to bring is that if the managing director of the day or senior management of the day bring to the board some proposal like Project Jetstream, having worked for a large media organisation and knowing the disruption that something like that brings in, she's probably going to be much more of a voice of sense, common sense, than Justin Milne certainly was.
And I did get the feeling at the conference when she was asked that question, it almost sounded like she felt like it was a bit condescending. She was like, of course someone that's worked in the media would know the issues. And I did feel like maybe she is starting to feel like she's being asked that question a bit too much. And obviously she does know the issues. I mean, anyone who's vaguely in the media does understand those issues.
Oh, most definitely. And we should keep in mind that while she hasn't been in a management or senior editorial role for that time, she has been kicking around the press for quite, and particularly television, for quite a long time now since she stepped down from editorial roles.
And also, Paul, there was a song that you kept referencing that I had no idea what you were talking about. Do you want to just explain what are you going on about?
I can picture Tim, who's not here today, listening to this and chuckling away at me being the oldest person in the building. And yeah, this is... I'll throw to Cold Chisel's Ida from 1980. I think it was in the top 10 for like 20 weeks in 1981.
And next up, Ten has had a rocky week this week with changing rooms being pulled from its schedule. Abby, what happened with this one?
Ten's changing rooms, which is a renovation program, I suppose, was pulled from air earlier this week. It debuted with 204,000 Metro viewers and then it saw a slight increase to 298,000, but then fell to 196,000 and crashed further to 135,000. So that is pretty poor ratings for a show that was on at prime time at 7:30. That's pretty low ratings, especially when you're going up against something like Nine's Married at First Sight, which has just been such a massive success for them. But I think the thing that's interesting about changing rooms, if we sort of look back to 2016, Nine had a renovation program on called Renovation Rumble, and that was considered as a flop and quote unquote it tanked, and its premiere was 395,000. So
that's almost double what Changing Rooms was getting.
Yeah, exactly. And so that premiered there, and then when it failed to break 450,000 Metro viewers, which is significantly higher than Ten's Changing Rooms, Nine moved the show out of prime time. And yeah, that was when it didn't break over 450 for the first four outings. So I think you could consider it as a big flop for Ten. And it is a shame because I think Ten, you know, now that I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here has finished and isn't in that prime time spot anymore. They really need to fill that gap and they need to fill it fast because, you know, Seven has My Kitchen Rules and Nine Married at First Sight, which both do very, very well for the networks. And Ten sort of has a bit of a gaping hole here at the moment.
Yeah, so just to put this into perspective, I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, which was on Ten, was pulling over 1 million Metro viewers on its opening night. So Ten has had a bit of a bad run of premieres quite recently. Dancing with the Stars premiered with 621,000 Metro viewers, which in the grand scheme of things actually doesn't sound that bad. But then Sunday Night Takeaway premiered with 383,000. So none of those numbers are looking that great for Ten.
And I mean, it's the second show that they've pulled recently. They also pulled Pointless 3 weeks ago after being on air for less than a year. So Ten is really struggling. And I think, you know, with the exception of The Bachelor and The Bachelorette, they really do need a new program to keep viewers interested in Channel 10 and to entice viewers to tune in and watch them. Because, you know, as a consumer, you think, you know, you have standout shows on Nine and 7 certainly at the moment, but 10, not a lot. I mean, every time I write the radio ratings, often their most watched program is 10 News First, and that's, you know, a fair way down the list.
And on top of that too, one of the big problems is we're talking about overall numbers in the demographics, which traditionally they used to do quite well in those younger demographics. Despite not having, say, a top 20 show, they'd still do well when you drill down. They're not even in the game there. I had one of the 10 PRs saying to me, oh, but if you take out all the news, then we're in the 16 to 39 demographic, I think they said. And I'm like, well, yeah, but you're rating less than the news, which tends to skew older in itself. Yeah. So they really do have a problem. And you've got to wonder, too, what this is doing to their share of ad spend as well, because you can't see advertisers spending that much money on things that people just aren't watching.
And do you think they're right to pull shows if they're performing that badly? Is it the right thing to do to almost treat it like a pilot week? It's almost like they're testing these shows in front of the audience and then just sort of giving up on them. Or should they really be sticking around, you know, trying to make it work and trying to grow the audience over time?
Well, I think there's three things that are a problem there. First of all, it's a really expensive way to do pilot weeks. Second, it's a big loss of face, a big loss of credibility. And third, if you're selling to those advertisers, you're having to sell in advance there. And of course, if you're not delivering the audiences that you're telling those advertisers you're going to get, there's a lot of money you're going to have to give back.
And I think the interesting thing that you pointed out there, Paul, is credibility, you know, their credibility with advertisers and certainly with media agencies as well. If you're going to be pulling shows all the time, it does make it really difficult to have that trust in the station and in the network that the numbers that they say are going to deliver are actually what they're going to deliver. And I think that's probably a big problem for the station.
And so next up, we're going to be playing with time a little bit to bring you a chat with Zoe, who has sadly departed us for a new role at The Australian. We will be chatting to her about her final big feature for Mumbrella, where she crunched 5 years worth of radio data. It was a lot of data.
That is a lot of data.
Zoe is here with us now to chat to us about a project that she has been tackling before she leaves, where she crunched 5 years of radio data from across the 5 metro cities. Zoe, why on earth did you do this? It's a big task.
Yeah, I'm mad. I shouldn't have started it. I have been doing radio ratings for probably about a year and a half. I think I've done something like, there's 8 surveys a year for those who don't follow the radio ratings, and I've done at least 2 years of that. And what I felt was that every single time we do it, we weren't really getting a very big picture. We were getting survey to survey, maybe 12 months, a 12-month look at best of particular radio shows or particular stations in each market. And I was getting really caught up in the different programming directors and their jargon as well. So they were all saying they were number one for whatever thing. And I just thought, you know, it's not very easy for our readers to actually work out how things are performing and how they've been performing over time and what's working and what's not working and what audiences changed. So I noticed in all of that that a couple of programmers were talking a lot about cumulative audience, which we can get to the breakdowns of that in a while. And I actually did a course with Commercial Radio Australia and GFK, who is a measurement provider for Commercial Radio Australia. And they sort of started breaking things down for me. And I thought, you know, it would be good to get an idea, given we have on the Commercial Radio Australia website 5 years worth of data, would be good to get an idea of what's actually happened in 5 years, what these stations look like. I know that we talk a lot about, say, in when Kyle and Jackie O, who are the KISS FM breakfast hosts, moved in 2014 over to KISS from Today FM. But what did that actually look like in numbers? What did that actually mean for the market? And is Today FM performing the way that everyone assumes they are? So there were things like that that I really wanted to get through. And so I decided that I would start this task that I thought took me 3 weeks, and it's taken me almost 6 months.
Well, so just before we get into what you actually found, the two pieces of data that you were looking at were the cumulative audience and the average audience. Now, for those who maybe aren't in the radio industry or have heard those terms and can never quite pin down exactly what they mean, could you give us a little explainer?
Sure. And if you want to read it instead of hear it, because I think some people like that, you can read it on the various stories. We've broken it down. But essentially, cumulative audience is looking at whether I listened to a show or station for at least 8 minutes per quarter hour within a given time period, like breakfast, drive. Average audience looks at the average number of people listening per quarter hour. So that might be a little bit confusing, but essentially average audience takes into account how much time I spent listening to a particular station or show, and cumulative audience looks at whether I listened at least once or not. So say there were a number of really loyal listeners to a particular show, like 2GB, you'd probably see their average audience to be quite high because they're spending a large period of time listening to it, whereas shows with new talent, or they might have done a big marketing campaign, will be looking for something like cumulative audience to spike the numbers. So they're looking at mass reach as opposed to how long people are actually spending listening.
Now, the first question everyone has been asking you when you tell them what you've been up to is, what did you find? Now, I imagine that's quite a difficult question to answer when there's so much data, but maybe let's take a look at each city more broadly, and just maybe if you could just explain a little bit what you found in each.
Sure. Look, there's so much to break down. And I think when people thought, I don't think anyone knew when I was speaking to a few people to help with this story, they understood what it would look like in the end, which is quite hard to explain to people. But essentially, there are a few key things that I learned from different stations in different markets. So if we break it down by station, there's some really strong performing stations for ARN, who owns WSFM Pure Gold and the KIIS Network across Australia, particularly in Sydney and Melbourne, Gold FM being the Melbourne sort of lead for them, and KIIS FM with Kyle and Jackie O, as I mentioned before, in Sydney, being a very strong station, as is WS. I noticed that for the Hit Network, which is owned by Southern Cross Austereo, the numbers seem to perform quite well in Brisbane and Melbourne. There was, for Triple M, it was actually Adelaide and Brisbane, which really surprised me, as opposed to Sydney and Melbourne, which they're quite well known for with their breakfast shows. Nova, which owns Nova and Smooth, not surprisingly, was fairly consistent in most markets. So massive pickup for both music stations, for ARN's WS and Gold, and also for Nova's Smooth. And of course, Nova's actual Nova Entertainment's Nova Network performed pretty consistent in every market, which is actually in line with what their programming director, Paul Jackson, has been saying to me for 2 years. So Paul, if you're listening, you fulfilled exactly what, or you have been telling me exactly what is happening for 2 years. So congratulations. I was not very surprised. There are obviously other things to take into account. So what I've noticed is cumulative audience has grown in every major capital city. So that's Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane, Adelaide, and Perth over the last 5 years, which means that, or there's lots of different things, ways you could interpret it. It could be a population growth, or it could just simply suggest that there are more different people listening to radio in those cities. What was interesting, though, was that average audience for Sydney and Melbourne had actually declined gradually year on year, which suggests that maybe while that Cume is going up, and so lots of different people are listening, they're probably not listening for the large periods of time that they might have. Whereas if you look at something like Adelaide, Perth, or Brisbane, average audience was fairly stagnant, which meant that people hadn't really changed how often they were consuming it despite Cume going up. So it was very different. The average audience told a very different story. The last thing that I'd probably say that I noticed when we're looking at stations was the story of Macquarie Media and some of their stations. So you've got something like 2GB in Sydney, 3AW, really strong brands, 6PR in Perth, which has slowly started to grow in that market. But then on the other hand, you have what was the former 2UE that's now Macquarie Sports Radio, and the changes that were made to Magic in both, or it wasn't even Magic, it was 4BH in Brisbane, then Magic, and then Magic down in Melbourne. There's just been so many changes over that time, and it's been fascinating to watch how that's actually affected audience, whether or not they've stuck around for it, did they adapt to it. It has been really, really interesting. And this year, particularly for the Macquarie Sports Radio channels, it's going to be really interesting to see whether the numbers go up, whether they attract a new audience in. The other thing that I'd probably say is that if we look at the AM dial as a whole, and I know that a lot of my work had a bit about declines in the ABC, the audiences tend to skew older for those stations anyway. There's that to consider. But overall, consumption of the AM dial has declined year on year. It's completely changed, and it's important to consider that too.
Obviously, this is a podcast, but there are some very nice shiny graphs that Zoe has made in all of these features. So if you're more of a visual learner, then it might be good to check those out. We'll leave a link to those in the description for this episode. So what has been the most challenging part of this whole process for you?
The most challenging part would be context. What has never been done before, or nothing that I've seen anyway, is not only putting those 5 years worth of data into graphs and looking at those numbers, but understanding changes to talent, changes to music formats, the implications of one station over another station in that particular market. And for me, I've spent a lot of my life in Sydney, and I've travelled to Melbourne a bit, so Sydney and Melbourne were a lot easier for me to understand the context, and I knew more or less how that radio market operated. I found it a lot harder as I got further away from Sydney, so Brisbane, Adelaide and Perth, to understand that. I was lucky that I obviously had people helping me in the background to understand these markets, and I'll be incredibly grateful for their help. But it was particularly difficult to go, okay, this person, why is there a huge spike at Survey 4 of 2015, or why did it drop off for 4 months? And I think, you know, a great example is there's a few different things, like the passing away of a talent star, or a star being suspended. Things like maternity leave are obviously going to affect those numbers as well. So it's just understanding all of those different spikes and all of those different what those implications mean. And it's not easy to find online, because what you find with most media outlets is they report on their markets. So the Perth papers will tend to focus solely on Perth talent. The Adelaide papers will work on Adelaide talent. Melbourne and Sydney are the same. So when you're looking at trying to understand, more broadly speaking, what is happening, it's actually, you have to go digging and you have to know what you're looking for before you start. And a lot of my time outside of just crunching numbers was just making sure I had all of those different changes in my head so that I could actually create a free-flowing conversation. And another challenge I had, and it's probably not been so, fundamental to what I've actually been working on, but something to keep in the back of your mind, is that every single network is going to feed you very different information. And even this week, I think I saw something in the AFR and Rear Window by Miriam Robin that was basically saying that Southern Cross Stereo had put its digital radio listeners on top of its the listeners that we've spoken about today, and made itself look bigger than all the other networks, so ARN, Nova, Macquarie, etc.
And was that in their financial results?
That was in their financial results. Now, the numbers that we did, we tried to do like for like, so they don't include the digital radio numbers which got introduced in later years. But it's an incredibly complex subject. It's incredibly hard to look through and dissect everything. And what I found was I had to sort of remove myself from all of that when I was working on this and just purely stick to what we had, and not what all the rhetoric that I've heard over the last 2 years to get this done. And I'm hoping that what we've created as a result is something that makes it clearer for our readers and clearer for people who aren't working in the radio industry and look at these numbers every single day. The other thing that was quite hard, but I can't take full credit for, was actually getting all the data entry done. So when I started this project, I did the Sydney market myself on top of my normal day-to-day work, and it took me almost 3 months. And I thought, oh my God, I am never going to get this done. So I actually have to say thank you very much to Rhea, who is our administration assistant at Mumbrella. Rhea took the time for me to go through the other markets and do some data entry. I honestly could not have got this project done in the time that I did without her. And she's done an incredible job. And she basically was responsible for looking at total market, breakfast and drive in every capital city before I put them into graphs. So thank you very much to Rhea.
Okay, cool. Well, thank you, Zoe, for explaining all that. And if you want to check out all these features and the shiny graphs, then you can follow the links in the description for this episode. Thanks, Zoe.
Thanks, Joyce.
Joining us in the studio, we have Shambles Communications' Gareth Eden-Stite and comedian Cam Knight.
Hello. Hey, Josie. How are you?
Hello. Thanks for having us.
That's all right. Now, if you're wondering why Cam and Gareth are here, that's because they're involved in Pitch to Punchline, which takes place on Monday, the 3rd of June, the week of Mumbrella 360, and will raise funds for mental health charity Batir. Cam is gearing up to mentor 20 applicants for 6 weeks before they perform at the gala event in front of up to 300 members of the industry at Sydney Opera House, no less. Cam, what's your What's your best advice for dealing with hecklers?
Well, sometimes it can be a bit of fun. Sometimes it can really ruin an evening. You've just got to gauge how that goes and put that spot far out pretty quickly. I mean, I enjoy a bit of crowd work every now and then, but yeah, you do have to make sure it doesn't get out of control and you lose the rest of the crowd. I had a person one time years ago that was so drunk in the crowd and they wanted to get on board and heckle, but they were so drunk they forgot how to speak English, so they were just screaming the word.
Was heckle, it? Heckle
at us. It's like, I don't know how to respond to that, you know.
It's probably worth pointing out, though, that we'll make sure that our event doesn't have any hecklers.
I mean, yeah, I will.
It's very much a safe environment. So no one's going to get on stage and have people going, you fucking fuck up.
Yeah.
No one's going to say that.
I will be. I'll be shouting it at them so we can experience this together. They'll know how to handle it. But no, I think even when I'll host the open mic event for them and also host the event at the Opera House, I'll make sure that the crowd is fully warmed up and that everybody understands the situation and what the environment needs, and to encourage no heckling, basically. Mm-hmm. It's just going to be a room of love, trust and understanding, isn't it, mate?
Yeah, well, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And if you want to become a standout stand-up or sponsor this cracking event, and why wouldn't you, you can visit pitchtopunchline.com. That's number two. And applications close on the 28th of March. Now, next up, we've got a chat between our very own Tim Burrows and Pure Profile CEO Nick Jones.
Next on the Mumbrella Cast, we're joined by Pure Profile CEO Nick Jones. Now, Nick joined Pure Profile in 2017, having previously been Chief Revenue Officer of Vevo, the music video joint venture owned by Universal Music Group, Sony Music Entertainment and EMI. And over a 30-year career, I don't know how it can possibly be with someone who looks so young, Nick's roles have included Managing Director of Yahoo Australia and New Zealand, Managing Director of News Corp, News Digital Media, and EMEA, Chief Digital Officer at Starcom MediaVest, which I think when I first crossed paths with you, Nick, because I remember back in my days on B&T, you spoke at one of our first digital boot camps when digital was a new thing. So I think that would have been in your Starcom days then.
I think it might have even been before. And actually, it's actually a really sad thing that my memory of those early days of digital in Australia were very focused around Australia being ahead of the curve. Indeed, I got asked and paid for to go to London to speak at a conference when, not long after we'd launched 9MSN, which is one of the other gigs that was in there between Fairfax and Yahoo. And we were way ahead of the UK. And I suppose, were one to look at today, you'd have to say that the tables have turned considerably. And I guess in that period, the digital business where we were, I mean, I vividly remember moving from Fairfax to 9MSN and agencies in particular, but clients saying, what on earth are you doing leaving newspapers to go to this internet thing? And it's just, I don't want to sound like a grumpy old man, but it's remarkable how you do sort of overestimate the short term and underestimate the long term.
And it's interesting
change.
What you say about newspapers as well, because, you know, sort of, I know at your time at News Corp, sort of News Digital was a sort of separate beast. Fairfax mm-hmm. had their digital operation, if I understand correctly, even a different building altogether. It felt like it took the newspaper industry a long time to wake up to the fact that digital was going to be one and the same and to think about it as one thing.
They certainly weren't slow in realizing what was happening. In fact, actually, my first connection with digital was at Fairfax. So I'm sure, you know, as they say, success has many fathers and failure is an orphan. But right at the very beginning, before there was any F2 or any Fairfax Digital, the very first digital activity Fairfax did was the computer section on a Monday, which was miles behind the Australian computer section, which was incredibly successful and lots of recruitment on a Tuesday. And we were looking for something to start digitally, and everybody was absolutely terrified of what it was going to do to the newspaper. So I think there was an acceptance that this was an important thing, and Fairfax sent me to the US back in 95 to go and see what the American newspapers were doing. So there was no lack of, oh, this is a thing. But to your point, the idea that it would be absolutely the main game or absolutely part of everything was clearly resisted for a long time. And I, you know, if you have editors who are incentivized, not necessarily monetarily, but incentivized by their circulation and their readership, and it's not in what people do on digital isn't included in that, then you kind of have two things at play that are counterintuitive.
And I guess the other thing you had as well at that point was classified, print classified was such a big part of the business model.
The rivers of gold.
Yes, indeed. The rivers of gold. To do anything that would potentially, even if it was disrupt yourself, disrupt that would have been quite a challenging thing to do.
Yeah, and that's the point. With Fairfax, the reason we went with the computer section is we were way behind the Australian. And we kind of had nothing to lose because we didn't have a lot of recruitment advertising in the computer section of the Herald. Whereas, I don't think I'm exaggerating. I think on a Tuesday, the Aussie maybe had, you know, 20 pages solid set of recruitment, of computer recruitment. So that whole idea of let's do something that won't disrupt, you know, our rivers of gold. And obviously Fairfax kind of in general had more of the rivers than anybody else did. Was definitely part of the thinking and the way that people were approaching digital.
Now you a little bit later on, so you went to News Corp with News Digital and then went agency side, mm-hmm. which is it's one of those cycles we still see today of people going back and forth, media owner to agency and back again. We've just seen Paul Brooks do it, obviously go from agency back to Channel 9, for mm-hmm. instance. People go in the other direction. How did you find the transition to the world of agencies?
I found it really hard. I think you're right. I really don't know how people view it now, but certainly when I did it, it seemed quite a natural thing to do.
And this was to Starcom.
This was to Starcom, and that was having left News, and it was kind of almost a backdoor into agency land because I set up my own consulting business, and Starcom came to me and said we're about to pitch for the General Motors business and we need some help with the digital part of the pitch. And it was an enormous pitch. I mean, there were some serious 24-hour days pulled, and the whole pitch itself probably took about a 6-month period. And I led the digital part of that. And I loved that. And that's what kind of hooked me in. I think when I got into agency land, I realized just how difficult it is. And I think for me, being in the middle where you had clients who were continually trying, making it difficult for you and sort of every 5 minutes, it seems, saying, well, we could go and give our business to somebody else. And then the bit I did know, which was the media agency nexus, I take my hat off to them. It's a really, really tough job. And as we know, agencies have had to keep reinventing themselves. And I mean, you wrote a piece on The Weekend about what's been happening with the Banking Royal Commission and have the agencies taken the hint of what that might mean. And
particularly where it comes to if you work for your client, you really have to work for your client.
You bet. And I think that's part of the difficulty for them. And the fact that, you know, everybody, there's the disintermediation, there's, you know, when Google first set out, there was the whole, well, we don't need agencies. We can go round agencies. We can go direct. And in my sales career, I've always believed that you have to have a relationship with the agency, but you also have to have a relationship with the client. And many agencies found that uncomfortable. And indeed, some agencies tried to stop you doing that, which I think ultimately just shows that it's a tough job. And agencies just seem to keep reinventing themselves and seem to keep thinking about, well, what's the next step? So for me, it was also because most of my agency life also included me moving countries and moving a family overseas. And I wouldn't change it for quids, but it was not without its challenges.
Nick, just go back to what you said earlier. You said that You said that a decade ago, maybe a bit longer, that the Australia was ahead in the digital media curve, and now seems to have fallen behind. What do you think caused that?
It's actually a lot more than a decade ago. I wish it wasn't, but I'm talking. So I went to 9MSN in 97. So it's 20 plus years ago. Look, I think, again, without wanting to sort of be the old guy in the pub going in the good old days, but you, when you've lived either in San Francisco or London for 10 years, which I have done up until recently, and you just see how much life is completely embraced, the digital world is completely embraced in what you do in terms of, you know, Wi-Fi speeds and all of that kind of stuff, online shopping, all of those things. I think it became a much more natural thing and grew because of it. I think in Australia, we had a lot of people who had a lot of vested interests in slowing down the things that would have helped us stay ahead. So for me, you know, the early days at 9MSN in Yahoo, we were all thinking about e-commerce and how we were going to be able to make a move in those spaces. And you have, companies like Seek and Car Sales and realestate.com. And there was all this chatter at the time that, oh, none of them were going to survive, you know. Now, I mean, I'm sure I've just listed, you know, a bunch of companies that are very, very successful, and I could probably think of a few that didn't make it. But this whole idea of they were to be resisted, and I think that's probably got a fair bit to play. There's no question our critical mass of people has to have had some form of part to play in that, where you don't just have enough people to be able to make new ideas work for long enough to get enough money to keep going. You know, you can launch something in the States or in the UK and it can be niche, but it can still have enough people to make a quid. The cost of, printing newspapers, whatever, it's not that different in the UK than it is in Australia. But if you're printing 400,000 instead of 30,000, there's a very big difference, you know, in the cost base and the opportunity.
Now, obviously, we talk about Yahoo, and that was in the days before Yahoo 7. And of course,
very much. I mean, Yahoo was very definitely, in those days when I joined, it was a search engine. And in my time there, we were talking about it not being a search engine because search engines weren't cool. And what you needed to be was a destination site.
And we've seen so many, obviously, so many different owners of or iterations of Yahoo and the whole sort of, I guess most recently the Verizon, until quite recently Verizon Oath, back in the day AOL. For some reason, of all of the brands, Yahoo has felt like the one that the US owners have come and gone in their level of commitment to Australia. What, as someone who's observed it all that time, what was going on there, do you think? Is it just that we're small in their thinking versus the bigger problems in the US that they're always coping with?
Look, I don't know. I mean, if you work for a global company, which I have a number, globally, in a properly global company, Australia is usually between 1% and 2% of your revenue. And yes, that makes it in the smaller section of the countries and the way that companies are set up. When Tony Fore set up Yahoo, I think, I might be wrong again, but I think Yahoo was like number three or number four in the Yahoo world. And when I took over from Tony, we were absolutely at the top table. We reported to America. And I mean, Australia always bats above its weight. I mean, I talk about 1% or 2%, and yet on any gauge of where Australia sits as a country globally, you're usually talking top 10 in terms of where it actually sits. But then the sheer scale of it makes it smaller. So maybe, I don't know, maybe there's no question that being, when I was setting up Vivo globally, we set Australia up very early. Part of that was because I knew Australia, and that made it easier for me to get through what is an incredibly complex area, which is music rights organisations and having a deal to actually legally be able to have.
Well, let's talk about Viva. This is good timing because I think, weirdly, the Beresford pub has featured quite a lot in Mumbrella's life over the years. It was where the name was cooked up, and it was where we had our notorious moment with the part where we wrote about the party with the big agency party with the burlesque strippers. But it was also where Vivo had their big launch for Australia, where I think was where you and I connected when you just reconnected when you just come back into into that role.
Yeah, I actually still have the photographs of that night, and actually that night was a. Was an incredibly special night for me personally because having left Australia, what would it have been? It would have been about 5 years before that, maybe four or five years, to come back to launch Vivo, to have all these agency guys there who, you know, you have these interesting relationships with, you know, when you're on the sales side and what have you, and to have Michael Gudinski there getting up on stage and raving about what we were doing with Vivo, which was fantastic. And I'm a, as you know, I'm a huge music head. So the idea that you could do these things, get some really good talent to come and sing, and have pretty much the Australian media and marketing industry all in one place. But going back to the original point, this whole idea of Australia being a place which is friendly, which is not difficult, sort of from a regulatory point of view, to set things up. And maybe, I don't know, maybe. I can't answer why Yahoo went all in its different ways, but I guess maybe Australia looks more attractive at the beginning, and then the revenues maybe aren't as big as suddenly when you start to get traction in France, and you see, you know, with 90 million people, you suddenly start seeing your revenues burgeon, and you go, well, actually, we should be spending a lot more time thinking about France and Australia.
Well, let's get into what you're up to now. So you've been a Pure Profile a little bit over a year now, would it be?
Yeah.
Paul, do you want to kick us off on this part of the conversation?
So last year when we spoke, you said that Pure Profile needed to explain better what it does. Do you think you're doing that?
I think we're getting better at it. I would never say we're there and we've done it. Part of that comment was born out of a belief really from my first day at Pure Profile that we had a very broad range of businesses. Too many, and getting focus of a business of our size on each of those businesses was going to be crucial. And I would have said to you, I know, I would have talked a lot about integration and the idea of being able to better bring parts of the business together. So I think that what we needed to do was be very clear on what we offered the market. And I think that has been difficult if you have disparate businesses. And I joined at a time when lots of people were saying, why did you buy this? Or why did you do that? And obviously, much as I wasn't there at the time, you have to get up to speed pretty quickly and understand what the thinking was within the business at the time. What I realized very early on and have been saying and banging on about as much as possible, even through all the things that have happened in the last 13, 14 months I've been there, is that we are primarily a technology company that is focused on data and insights. And that is at the center of everything we do. And there's no point for me of having any of the businesses we had at that point if they didn't plug into that. And so data and insights and... You know, it's very easy to talk about data and analytics, and it's, you know, all the cool kids are doing that now. But you've got to think a bit more differently in terms of the equality of the value exchange between consumer and provider. You've got to think about the transparency that's needed in today's world of when people are giving information over. What we do, it's all about, you know, you're giving us information. It's active. It's not, we're not doing something behind your back. And yet, you know, we've just done some research recently with 50 that talks about people going, well, hold on a minute. If I'd known that by doing that with Facebook, I was giving them this much information, then I'm not sure I want a dedicated advertising, you know, or relevant ads if I have to get, if the price of that is giving this information. And there's that whole, I think we're right in the thick of it now, where there's this whole idea of, well, if my data is that important, then what's the exchange for it? And what we're trying to do at Pure Profile is really aim very definitely at being in the middle and pushing for a fair exchange and equality between brands and consumers.
And I suppose Pure Profile, because I think back to it, so I'm guessing it began to cross my radar in about 2010, 2011, mm-hmm. Maybe even a fraction later. But at that point, it felt like the central point was it was a consumer panel. So the idea being that effective people were paid to do surveys, mm-hmm. share what they think about brands, and they're actually incentivized with, you know, a few cents or, mm-hmm. or a few dollars if they did a lot of it. The idea being then that would help advertisers actually talk to those people. So it wasn't just research panels. It was actually then helping those advertisers speak directly to those people. And I remember even then I chatted to Paul Chan, the founder, who's, I think, not involved in the day-to-day, but still a major shareholder as far as I know. And you could see he had a brain the size of a planet, but it was incredibly complicated to get across what he saw, mm-hmm. just because it was a burgeoning space. We weren't in panic mode about privacy and transparency mm-hmm. at that point. And I suppose that's always the challenge for any tech agency CEO is how do you simplify something that's fundamentally complicated?
Look, I think from my perspective, it's very easy. I'm not, I wouldn't say I'm a simple guy, but I am absolutely not a technologist. And I have to see the value. If I go back to my base skill, I started life after uni in work as a sales guy. And if you're going to sell something to somebody, if you can't explain it easily and help them understand what the benefit of buying whatever it is you're selling to them, you ain't going to be a successful salesperson. Now, I'm lucky I was a successful salesperson. And maybe it's not luck. Maybe it's the understanding of how you go about being able to help people understand what the benefit is of what you have. And I think that to me is fundamental in terms of if you have a service, a business, whatever, people need to understand what they're getting. And I mean, your point about the panel, I mean, that's still very much at the heart of Pure Profile. But whereas maybe previously it was always seen as you get some cents or some dollars, my view has constantly been that there could be a different exchange for people to give up their data or their information. And the, you know, it's an easy example for me because, as I said, I'm a music nut, but if you think about Spotify, you think about the idea that if Spotify want to know more about me, what have Spotify got that would be of value to me? And that would either be some form of discount on my monthly subscription, or possibly even more, access to some content that I get specially because I've shared my information. And that's just the easiest way for me to describe it, because that's the value. Now, actually, the value of what I get might still only be a few cents or a dollar or two, but it means so much more to me. And that's when you start to think about, so you don't just want to attract people who want to get, you know, want to make 20 bucks a month on giving their data or selling their data. You actually want to attract people like me. And on that basis, I don't have 20 minutes to fill out a survey. So how are you going to attract me in a different way? And I think as a business, that's the challenge.
And I was going to say, and I suppose the other challenge for you as a CEO is, it's probably like that for any CEO of any ASX company. You've got a product, it's how you talk about it, it's how you think about it, but you've also just got all of those distractions that come with running a company.
Correct.
And you inherited a company that was facing some pretty tough financial challenges. As you say, you were untangling some previous acquisitions. Last week we talked about the fact that you just sold the Cohort acquisition, mm-hmm. which had been acquired before you were there. Bad share price at the moment. So last time I looked, I think the market cap was like 3 million or something.
Yep.
There's been plenty of stuff historically about battles between the shareholders who went public on all of that. It feels to me like you need some sort of game changer to focus on the business.
Well, I think, honestly, I look at it and say moving on cohort is part of that. And if you think about what's happened in the year I've been at Pure Profile, a lot has changed. And all of that has been around firstly focusing on the health and the future of the business, and sort of equal first, the people. I mean, if you don't look after your people, if you don't motivate your people, if you don't have a great culture, then you don't really have much of a business in the first place. And so I've looked at what I thought a future Pure Profile, successful Pure Profile would be, and am working very definitely towards that. And I think what you saw with the cohort sale was possibly one of the last pieces of the jigsaw in that. I think there's a couple of other pieces, and very soon you'll see some announcements about some of the things we're doing, some of the clients that we're working with and the way we're working with them, that I hope will really crystallize what we're doing as a business. And to go back to the question you asked me about, you know, what do you do and what's the simple message, is helping people or helping businesses better understand consumers, and in turn giving consumers true value out of that process.
And let's talk about some of your people briefly. Do you have all of your key people in place now?
I think you're always in an organization is a living sort of breathing organism. So you're always in some form of flux. I think the best thing that I feel that I've given the business is, from a shareholder perspective, clarity on what we're trying to do, and then on the people that are going to lead the business. So I think we're comfortable that, or I'm comfortable that we have really good people running the business.
And talk us through some of the key people. I guess somebody who'd be certainly familiar to listeners of the Mumbrella Cask is Ben Sharp.
Yes. Well, interestingly, Ben left the business recently.
Ah, okay. So, is this a Mumbrella exclusive, or did I fail to read this while I was on holiday?
I don't know if it's been reported anywhere in particular, but Ben decided that he wanted to go off and do something else, and so Ben left us a couple of weeks ago. And I think, you know, therein lies an interesting part about culture and about people. And I guess when we start somewhere, we all go, okay, is this, you know, what I expected it to be? Is this what I wanted it to be? And obviously, for whatever reason, Ben decided that he wanted to go and do something different.
So does this mean you're open to resumes from people with sales experience? Or?
Well, you know, it's interesting. When Ben was leaving, obviously, I knew that the cohort sale was imminent. And on that basis, my view was, well, let's get beyond the cohort sale, because actually, maybe what I need in that space is something different to what I thought I needed when Ben joined us.
And also, you're from a sales world yourself anyway, so it's a world you understand.
And I've actually spent the last 2 weeks seeing our clients. And for me, that's a great thing, because it's actually, as I said, it's how I started out in business, and I actually love doing it. And I think it gives them a platform to say, okay, well, we've got the CEO, he's listening. What can we do better? How can we better engage? What are you trying to do with your business?
If we look at sort of Pure Profile in a year's time, how will it look?
For me, Pure Profile is yet to really deliver on the most exciting piece of all, which is our platform. We have a fantastic and long-standing relationship with News Corp. And again, going back to Paul's vision years ago, the vision of one profile for a person that covered declared data, not that it was called that in those days, opinions, behavior, that enabled, in this case, a publisher to better understand their consumers, and had the opportunity then to have an exchange, a bit like I was talking earlier, an exchange where it's not necessarily about money, it might be about access to content in terms of News's behind News's subscription walls, that we believe is, and I believed when I joined the company, is the most exciting thing that we do. And we're now able to start rolling that out. And that's, I mentioned earlier, maybe some announcements that we'll talk about soon coming through with some clients that we're working in that way. But the reality is, if it's no coincidence that the major, if you like, content distribution companies that are really driving forward and being successful now are predominantly based on user pay models and not advertising models. And I don't think that's
for a whole other podcast, well, isn't
believe,
it?
Believe me, I think that today the advertising market is as, maybe they don't realize yet, but is as challenged as it's ever going to be in terms of users, that going back to that fair exchange, the idea that users do get now that they're prepared and they need to pay for the content they love. I think news had a big part to play in that years ago when they built a paywall and it was very, very uncool to do so. You think about the Netflixes, the Stans, and the idea that people are prepared to pay to get the content they really want. That then starts to challenge the advertising model. And I think if you're thinking about a user, content creator, direct relationship, Pure Profile has a really exciting part to play in that in terms of the technology we have and the way that we can help bring those together.
Nick, thanks so much for finding the time to talk to us.
Thanks very much, guys.
And just before we go, the entry deadline for this year's Mumbrella Awards is coming up quick. You've got about 2 weeks to pull your entries together with the submission deadline on March 15th. So if you haven't already, be sure to head over to mumbrella.com.au/Mumbrella Awards, that's with two A's, to review the categories and see which ones you qualify for. And if you've got any questions, you can shoot them through to Lauren on lauren@mumbrella.com.au. Okay, that's all for this week. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, Jess.
Bye.